Well, it's my pleasure to welcome all of you to our forum today. I think it will be a very interesting one. And I remember just as I walked in the door to turn off my cell phone, and I would ask any of you who has a cell phone to turn it off so that we don't have any interruptions. It's a real honor to welcome our speaker today, newly minted Dr. Yehezkel Landau from Hartford Seminary. Yehezkel has done a lot of work on interfaith relations, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, and also as this relates to the religious aspects of peace building, particularly related to Israel and Palestine. In addition to his degree from Hartford Seminary, he has both a bachelor's and a master's from Harvard University. He has lived and worked considerably in Israel-Palestine and has been at Hartford Seminary for, I guess, the last 11 or so years. We very much look forward to him talking with us about Abrahamic partnerships in pursuit of peace, both from a professional as well as personal aspect. And after he speaks, he will be ready to engage in some discussion, questions and answers. And I think I'll just point out that because we're doing this as a podcast, we would ask each person when you have questions to come to this mic so you can line up there. And so rather than get up and say that later, I'll just let him transition into the Q&A and ask that people who want to ask questions line up and go to the microphone. So Yehezkel, we're so pleased to have you here and look forward to all that you have to share with us today.
Many thanks. Ed, shalom, assalamu alaikum, peace and blessings to all of you. Thank you for coming on what seems like a spring day to me. It was snowy and frigid in Hartford this morning, so thanks just for bringing me south to a warmer climate, at least for 24 hours. I want to share with you some reflections based on my experience in the Middle East for a good part of my adult life, and my work at Hartford Seminary, which is its own laboratory for interreligious and international engagement. We have a good number of Christian and Muslim students from around the world who come to this little campus in the middle of Hartford, and I welcome you to come and visit sometime and meet the people I have the privilege of working with and learning from. So, as Ed mentioned, I lived in Jerusalem from 1978 to 2002 when I came to Hartford. Before that, I was teaching and doing interfaith work in the United States. I had been in the Hudson Valley of New York at Bard College for the 2 years before moving to Jerusalem in 78. Before that, 10 years or so in the Boston area where I got my 2 degrees from Harvard University and Harvard Divinity School. And before that, I grew up in Rockland County, New York, just north of Bergen County, New Jersey. And before that, I spent my first 3 years of life in Santiago de Chile. So I actually spoke Spanish before I spoke English, but sadly, I lost all my Spanish when we came to Forest Hills, Queens, and the other children were making fun of me, and I went home and told my mother I'm not going to speak Spanish again. Big mistake. So that whole cultural, linguistic window was closed for me. Maybe I'll go back there someday. So let me just share a little bit of my personal journey, and you'll see where I'm coming from when I talk about Middle East peace building, as well as Jewish, Christian, Muslim relations. And for me, they are interwoven and will remain so. So I mentioned that I was born in Chile. How did I get there? Because my parents had moved there. My father was working as a Latin American representative for MGM Films. He and my mother, before they were married, in 1938 had fled Vienna just in time, just before Germany annexed Austria into the Reich, the Anschluss. Some of my cousins were not so fortunate and perished in the Shoah, the Holocaust. And once we got to New York, I was a student in public schools, and then at Harvard was interested in psychology, theology, and education, all of those areas together. My Christian mentor was the late Bishop Christer Stendhal, Swedish Lutheran bishop, Pauline scholar, and from him I learned the concept holy envy as the ideal outcome of interreligious encounter, to appreciate beauty, richness, holiness in a tradition other than your own without converting to it, but taking on some of that consecration in your own faith life. So that's been important to me. For example, when I think of the Hajj pilgrimage, I have holy envy. When I think of the daily discipline of Muslims praying 5 times a day rather than 3 times a day, which is the standard for us, I have holy envy. I take retreats in convents and monasteries, so I'm not your typical Jew just because of that, especially because I embrace silence. Jews and silence don't always go together that easily or naturally. We're a very verbal people, which is why we were told at Sinai, listen, O Israel, Shema Yisrael, stop talking just long enough to hear the word of God. And we had to be in the desert because there would have been a lot of distractions and a lot of people talking, a lot of noise coming out of Egypt. So I mentioned I was at Bard College in the Hudson Valley from 1976 after getting my master's degree from Harvard Divinity School. And I was doing some interfaith and intercultural teaching as well as writing grant proposals for the school. And that was the marketable skill which has actually helped me until today. But that's what got me to Israel when the rabbi who headed a yeshiva gave me a one-way ticket to get me from New York to Israel in April 1978. And I didn't really buy the other half of the ticket until I came to Hartford in 2002 and thought I would never actually come back to the United States, but for family and professional reasons, and I think some providential intentionality, I was brought back to these shores in order to do my little piece of global peace building from the American side rather than the Middle East side, and that's partly because things are really stuck, pathologically stuck in the Middle East, though there's a lot of fervent change now all around the region, and hopefully when the dust settles, people will be more liberated and free to speak and to meet one another, hopefully across borders. And I was the last member of my immediate family to ever set foot in Israel, and the only one who stayed for a quarter of a century, because I didn't go as a tourist or even as a pilgrim, but as a prospective resident, and ended up taking on dual citizenship. I felt I had come home to Jerusalem, and I had put my body where my prayers had already taken me for years, since Jerusalem, the Holy of Holies on the Temple Mount, or the Haram al-Sharif, remains our Qibla, our orientation, our epicenter in the cosmos for prayer and for pilgrimage. So everything I've just mentioned was motivated by my religious convictions as a human being. That's how I identify myself. I'm a human being. So I try to do justice to the specifically or particularistically Jewish side of my identity as well as my universal humanists. And my Judaism includes both a religious Zionist commitment to the security and well-being of the state of Israel. I'll unpack that. If I say religious Zionist, I do not mean chauvinist or territorialist. And the religious already modifies the national dimension of my Jewishness. And my Jewishness includes a commitment to justice and peace, true peace, shalom for all peoples, based on our common heritage, as our common origins as created in the image of God, and our common prophetic heritage, at least in the Abrahamic traditions, which call us to transform society, to make our world more holy. So my interfaith engagement deepened in Israel. Jerusalem is this, it's kind of a holy epicenter that has messianic potential, but is right now trapped in this tragic conflict, the latest round of unholy warfare to conquer or possess or dominate her rather than share her holiness. In Psalm 87, at the end, the psalmist says, everybody is born or reborn in Jerusalem. It's though we have two birth certificates. I have a birth certificate that says I came out of my mother's womb in Santiago de Chile in September 1949, but my soul, and if you believe the psalmist, all of our souls, I don't know what the Chinese would say about this, but all of our souls are somehow linked from the beginning of creation with the Holy of Holies. And in fact, the Jewish mystics say the Aleph point, the point of creation and the foundation stone for the whole cosmos, in Hebrew, Evan Ashtiyah, is actually where the Holy of Holies was located and where the two temples stood, and now where the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Dome of the Rock, the Mosque of Omar, now stand. So that was cosmically holy before the Jebusites and then King David, who bought the threshing floor from Arabna, the Jebusite, and then the Israelites. Solomon built a temple there. The Muslims built their two holy shrines, buildings there, the distant Al-Aqsa Mosque. So all of that was part of God's intentionality from creation. So when I got on a plane in 1978, I felt like an iron filing in a magnetic field, and my body was being drawn to that place. And every time I pray, I align myself with this magnetic field. So this is what's kept, I believe, the Jewish people intact, even when we were in exile from the land. There's some kind of spiritual force field that links us to that place. Sadly, that place is also holy for other people. I'm not sad about that. But the sad thing is, we fight over it. And we can't somehow take the psalmist's invitation to heart and expand our identities as Abrahamites, let's say, or as Jew human beings and Christian human beings and Muslim human beings and Baha'is and Druze and others, and go on pilgrimages to the place together, even if we keep our prayers distinct. So that dialectical dance is what I've been trying to do for as long as I can remember, to find a sacred balance, I would say, between the particularistic and the universalistic dimensions of my identity, and I would say all of our faith traditions. And this is not an easy task as a religious educator, starting with my own community, but with others as well. I don't have to really flesh this out. There are people who tend far toward the universalist, humanist end as believers and practitioners of different faiths. And there are people who are exclusivists or parochialists, chauvinists, whatever you want to call them, self-segregationists, who are probably doing more damage than the humanists or the universalists. But to keep these two tendencies, two models of faithfulness, integrated together, even in creative tension, is, I think, part of our task. And maybe I'll spell that out a little bit later, but I want to continue a little bit about with my story. So I have both joy and anguish over the reestablishment of a sovereign Jewish state in God's holy land as a laboratory, I understand biblically, prophetically, as a locus for practicing not just individually as kind of saintly role models, but as collectives called Israel and Palestine, collectives committed to justice and peace, inclusive justice, inclusive peace. So when I link up to that place three times a day in prayer and in my dreams, in 90% of my dreams, and I've been recording my dreams since at least 1974, in at least 90% of my dreams, I'm actually in Israel. So on a deep psychic level, I've never left. So even if I did buy the other half of the ticket and get myself to Bradley Airport in Hartford, I didn't really leave Jerusalem. And my son is there, he's 24 years old. So my commitment to the future of that place and the next generation, generations, is still an animating part of my being. So my work in the Holy Land, first of all, I was the program coordinator for the Israel Interfaith Association, bringing Jews, Christians, Muslims, Druze, and Baha'is together to understand one another. Then I was the director of the religious peace movement called Oz V'Shalom Nitivot Shalom. Oz V'Shalom means strength and peace from the last verse of Psalm 29. The Eternal will grant God's people strength and bless God's people with peace. Hashem Oz Li'amo Yiten Hashem Yevorech Et Amo V'Shalom. That's half the name. Nitivot Shalom comes from the verse in Proverbs that says, V'chol Nitivoteha Shalom, all of the Torah's paths or pathways are peace. So the way, it's not just the end point is peace, but the way to get there has to embody peace. So the religious peace movement, which I was directing through the 1980s, tries, first of all, to make peace between the two primary camps in Israel, at least until the last election. Now we have a centrist party called There Is a Future, Yesh Atid, with 19 out of 120 Knesset members, headed by Yair Lapid, which just broke the mold and has women and men and non-observant and fully observant, one super-Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox rabbi, 19 new faces in the parliament. But until this last election, the two main camps that were reflected in extra-parliamentary peace movements, and all, as well as political parties in the Knesset and sometimes in the government, were, I'm going to put this under grossly simplistic headings, the secular left and the religious right. Okay, so if I say the Peace Now movement and Uri Avneri's Gush Shalom, all of the left-leaning peace movements, that's one camp, the so-called peace camp, and then the national or nationalist camp, Hamachaneh Lumi, is most fervently represented in the settler movement, the Gush Emunim, the Block of the Faithful settler movement, which is now reflected in Habayit HaYehudi, the Jewish Home Party, led by Naftali Bennett, who's this high-tech millionaire, who was for a short time Netanyahu's chief of staff and also the head of the settlers' council, the Judea, Samaria, and Gaza settlers' council. He came in third, his party. So, to make peace, to find a what I would call a holy, the highest, holiest common denominator between the secular left and the religious right in Israel is probably harder than making peace between Israel and Palestine. And one of the reasons, I would say the primary reason we don't have peace yet, a just, inclusive peace between Israel and Palestine, sharing Jerusalem as a common capital, in the spirit of the 87th Psalm, is because Israel, Jewishly, I'm just talking about the 80% of the citizens who are Jewish, not the 20% who are Palestinian Israelis, about 97% Muslims and 3% Christians, the Jewish majority is fragmented ethnically and politically between, let's say, the secular left and the religious right. There are other parties, but I'm concerned mostly about them. And I don't have to tell you that Palestine is geographically, spiritually, ideologically separated between Hamas and Fatah, each of them administering part of Palestine, Gaza, and parts, large parts of the West Bank. How each of these polities will make internal peace is very much a factor in determining whether the two nations will ever live together peacefully. So part of the reason I joined the religious peace movement in Israel and was running the staff for a decade, rather than being involved, let's say, in peace now, was I believed and still believe firmly that all of us, at least in that conflict situation, I won't be chutzpahdik, I won't be audacious enough to start prescribing remedies for other pathological situations on the planet, but I think in other conflicts, at least some other conflicts, where the religious factor is a part of the problem. It's obviously a part of the problem in Israel-Palestine because it is a land called holy by several prophetic traditions. That in such instances, we need spiritual remedies for our political pathologies. It was Einstein who said, in order to solve problems, we have to come from a different angle from which the one that created them. Political agreements alone, as we saw with the Oslo Accords, won't work. If we don't engage the religiously fervent activists, which is about 20% of Israelis and maybe more, at least 20% of Palestinians, those who want, let's say, for whom a Jewish state is even more important than a democratic state, or a Palestinian state has to be Islamic. For those who are faithful in those ways, we need to find religious vocabularies in agreements and religiously resonant gestures that reach the soul and get through the ideological filters, some of which are passing as theologies. But there has to be emotional engagement, especially where people are in pain and rage because of their pain. My spiritual brother and colleague Mark Gopin is going to speak soon in this forum series. So he'll say, in his own words, more or less the same thing. By the way, I'm very pleased and feel privileged to be in the company of some of the other people, like Najiba Said Miller and Dr. Akrami here. So thank you for including me in this series. So my work has been motivated by this conviction that we need a spiritual approach to peace building. And that's why coming to EMU, I feel spiritually very much in concert with what is being done here. So the atrocities of September 11th in New York and Washington and the field in Pennsylvania helped to convince me that the pathology that I was experiencing in the Middle East every day had gone global, and that we need international channels for redirecting the energy from violence to just peace building. So I mentioned that Hartford Seminary is a laboratory unto its own. I teach courses in Jewish tradition. I'm teaching actually an interfaith course now. It's got a designation dialogue rather than scripture. used to have a scriptural SC designation. Now it has a DI designation. It's called Suffering, Theodicy, and Repentance, Interreligious Readings of Job and Jonah, Ayub and Yunus in the Quran, who are prophets in the Islamic tradition, both of them. Jonah is a prophet in the biblical tradition. Job is this kind of strange everyman figure from Utz. It's not clear where he comes from. Bruce Vorter, a Catholic priest who actually has a book called Job and Jonah, calls him an Edomite sheikh. It's not clear. It's not all that important where he's located, because he stands for all of us, and there's a Job in each of us, and there's a Jonah in each of us. So I teach courses that are grounded in the Jewish tradition, including Kabbalah, the mystical tradition. I'll say something about that very shortly, how it relates to peace building, especially in the Middle East. And I also direct a program every June for one intensive week called Building Abrahamic Partnerships. If you give me your email address, I can send you the syllabus, and you can check it out and see whether you want to take part the last week of June. It's been called Interfaith Boot Camp. It is a very engaging and transformative experience from one Sunday dinner to the next Sunday dinner. And it includes a day and a half of text study in small groups using Hebrew scripture, New Testament, and Holy Quran texts that in both cases are ennobling and inclusive and loving, like the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew, as well as texts that sound violent and even vicious and not tolerant or inclusive. How do we deal with those texts before they get turned into weapons? And they've been used as weapons for centuries. So how do we deal with that now? And how do we equip ourselves to go out and help other people interpret those texts and preempt their misuse in the direction of hostility, domination, and destruction? So, here are some questions that guide my work in general. Since I affirm the covenantal link from Abraham's day until now between the people of Israel and the land of Israel / Palestine, and that this has been sanctioned by God, at least for millennia, and I believe that my faith conviction doesn't give me any superior rights or claims to territory or to power over anyone else, how can my faith convictions coexist, not just coexist side by side, but mutually enrich the faith convictions, the sacred narratives, and in very practical terms, the territorial claims of Christians and Muslims who view the holiness of the land in their own terms? How do we have a discussion about this, and how do we reach some kind of spiritual consensus? And then a political map that reflects that spiritual reconciliation. That's my question. That's my applied theology and applied spirituality. In very practical terms, how can we all share the holiness of that land and of this holy mother city, Jerusalem, in ways that mutually enhance each other's spirituality and the practical lives of our communities, especially so that our children don't grow up fearful and hateful? So these are my questions that are naturally in conversation with the questions of others, and I want to hear your questions in a little while. And I believe that we need as much collective wisdom as we can muster in order to tackle these global challenges with Jerusalem as the epicenter. So the peace work that I've done is within the context of thinking globally or cosmically, mystically even, but acting very concretely and locally. So the context seems to be, I'm going to give you my kind of spiritual slash political map. This is the context in which I think I'm operating, and you can push back if I'm not reflecting your identifications accurately. But I want to be explicit. I'm trying to tell you where I'm coming from, and I want to know where you're coming from. I'll start with Jews, my own community. My community is, guess what? Not united. It's very fragmented. But this is, you know what the national pastime is of Jews? Arguing. Really, we've refined this into a spiritual art. Really, we can't be dogmatic if we've had a proper Jewish education, because the Talmud is just based on this rabbi said this, and another one said this, and another one said this, and then we have to take each side and come up with rationales for every point of view. That's the saving grace of my oral tradition. The biblical tradition is a little bit more monological. Thus saith the Lord, says a prophet. Okay, that's hard to argue with. You either agree with it or you don't. This person is either channeling revelation or not. Okay, by the time the sages came and the Talmud was compiled, nobody was claiming a hotline to heaven. They were asserting their authority as interpreters, as readers and interpreters of Scripture. So we've always been involved in what our tradition calls a dispute for the sake of heaven. In Hebrew, machloket l'shem shamayim. I'm actually very happy with this. And I extend it to Christians, Muslims, and anybody else. And I try to invite my fellow Jews to extend it to people who might have a strong disagreement about what the Zionist homecoming may mean, for example, especially to Palestinians, which is, for Jews, it's a dream fulfilled. For them, it's a nightmare still ongoing. So how to have an honest conversation about those feelings and those understandings of identity and destiny, that's tough. Okay, and Jews don't always talk about this peacefully either. So because we're passionate, many of us are passionate about Israel, we split among the passionate nationalists, if not chauvinists. That's not my kind of Zionism, but there are people, quite a few Jews in the land and outside, who believe this is the homeland of the Jews as a collective, and there are no other national rights to be honored there. If Palestinians, for example, or others want to live there, they should be treated as individuals but not a national collective. Then there are the passionate universalists who endorse the political and human rights of the Palestinians as Jews. Faithful Jews. There's a small number of religious or secular anti-Zionists, the Satmar Hasidim and the Neturei Karta people. And then there are a large number of Jews who take no position whatsoever on the Middle East, in some cases because of a nominal or a weak Jewish affiliation. So there are Jews all over the map, and I work with all of them. Christians in the West, who engage this issue, tend to divide into two theological and political camps, and like Jews and Muslims, theology and politics for them are mutually reinforcing. I think that's an inevitable result of prophetic faithfulness. So those who say, well, let's separate religion from politics, I don't see how that's possible, and certainly not desirable. We need a healing theology and politics, if only to combat the destructive theological politics or political theology that we see also in this country. So in the Christian world, there are a lot of apathetic people also, but for those who take the Holy Land seriously, fervently, you have a pro-Jewish or Zionist camp led by evangelical Protestants. They even see Muslims slash Arabs as and the embodiment of some antichrist. I'll let you deal with that, those of you who are Christians. Okay, to me, this Fortunately, Barbara Rossing, a good Lutheran colleague of mine in Chicago, calls this heresy, the Scofield Bible, millennialists, the rapture people. She has a great book called The Rapture Exposed, The Message of Healing and Hope in the Book of Revelation. So you have the evangelical Protestants who are often more Zionist than many Jews, and a pro-Palestinian camp led by liberal and liberationist Catholics and Protestants, often inspired by the fervent, pained and hopeful testimonies of Palestinian Christians, some of whom are my colleagues and friends. So my own position, if you haven't figured out by now, is a dialectical one, which is tough to sell, by the way, because as Yeats said, you know, to be in the middle is hard when people have already chosen up sides and they're polarized. So I have a religious Zionist peace perspective. Try that on. Okay? Rather than a doctrinaire position favoring any one side exclusively, I believe in the right of the Jewish people to self-determination in a majority Jewish state within God's holy land. And at the same time, I recognize the parallel right of the Palestinian people to their own state within that same territory, which is their homeland too. Accommodating both of these rights and claims to sovereignty and to territory requires a political and a territorial compromise, but there has to be a spiritual foundation, not just mutual acceptance, I believe. So my politics come out of my spirituality and my religious convictions. At bottom, I see that land as a divinely chosen laboratory for consecration by all its inhabitants, primarily through acts of justice and loving kindness. And this goes back to Genesis 18:19, where Abraham, it says of Abraham, he practices the way of God, Derech Hashem, to live by mishpat and tzedakah, justice and loving kindness. So the Peace Education Center that I co-founded after directing the work of this religious peace movement for 10 years is a micro laboratory within the laboratory of Israel-Palestine for justice and peace building. And this center called Open House is an epicenter for Abrahamic healing, because it's the home of two people, two families from the two peoples. The house in Ramle, between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, Al-Ramle, not Ramallah in the West Bank, Al-Ramle, not far from Ben Gurion Airport, in Lod. It was built by Ahmed Al-Khiri in 1936, and he and his family, his wife and children, were expelled at gunpoint by the Israeli military in July of 1948, as during the war that established Israel and also created about 750,000 Palestinian refugees. So the Palestinians call this the Great Catastrophe, Al-Nakba, and Jews call it Milchemet HaShikrur, the War of Liberation or Independence. Milchemet Atzmaut. So there you have the two narratives in direct opposition over what is the meaning of this clash that came to a head in 1947 to 1949. So this particular house and garden reflect the wider inability to share the land and consecrate it together. A few months later, in November of 1948, a family from Bulgaria immigrated with 50,000 Bulgarian Jews to the new state of Israel in the middle of the war. Their name was Ashkenazi. A baby girl named Deniza, today Dalia, then Deniza Ashkenazi, today Dalia Landau, my former wife, to whom I was married for 25 years, and the co-founder of this peace education laboratory with me. She moved into the house and grew up there. And she always wondered, who lived here before we arrived? After the Six Day or the June War in 1967, Bashir al-Khairi and two of his cousins rang the bell at the outer gate, and Dalia opened the gate and realized, this is the other half of the puzzle. She said, I felt I was waiting for them all of this time. A young woman, she welcomed them in, and Bashir told her that what was now Dalia's bedroom used to be his. She had a famous cover of Life magazine on the wall, which you can find if you Google it, which had an Israeli soldier in the Suez Canal holding his rifle above his head with a broad smile on his face after this quote-unquote miraculous victory, this feeling of deliverance in 6 days in June 1967. So these two families are still in touch until today. And out of this very special relationship, where the Al-Khairis came back to their home in Ramla, Dalia visited them on Palestine Street in El Bira several times, sometimes with me, the two families decided to dedicate this common house and the garden for two purposes. One, as an affirmative action, head start nursery school for the Arab community, Palestinian Israelis, Christians and Muslims in that area, because there was no such facility when we began in 1991. Now there are others serving Arab toddlers. That was half of what Open House, the name of the project, Open House was created to do. The other half was to create opportunities for children, teenagers, adults from these two estranged communities, even as Israeli citizens living pretty much segregated lives, to come together and share in joint activities and become friends and partners in what I would call Abrahamic justice and peace building. So Open House was founded in April 1991, just a few months after the first Gulf War. And through two intifadas and a few wars, short and longer, the house is still open and is still functioning. And for me, is a symbolic center of healing and hope in the midst of this war zone, which generates a lot of discouraging news every day. I invite you to go and find this place on the web. Visit it virtually, friendsofopenhouse.org. I'm the chair of Friends of Open House USA, which is the support network for the work being done there. Friendsofopenhouse.org, you'll actually be led to two websites, and you can choose, one in Israel, one in North America. And if you come to the Holy Land, to Israel-Palestine, please pay a visit and see what is happening there. I'll share with you, and then we'll have a conversation. I'll give you the biblical basis for what I am doing. There, right here, right now, in Hartford. First of all, the house I see as a vessel for sharing the Abrahamic blessing among three families of the three Abrahamic traditions and then expanding it outwards to other families. The Al-Khairis are Muslims. Dalia and I, our family is Jewish. A Christian Palestinian family named Fanous was instrumental in the founding of this house and its administration for years, and one of the teachers in the nursery school was from that family. So three families of the three faiths co-created, co-led, co-envisioned this peace education laboratory. So in Genesis chapter 12, verse 3, Abraham, when he's brought from what is today near Basra, Iraq, to what was then Canaan, Canaan, is told, through you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. That's a very interesting choice of language. Distinct family identities will remain. Humanity will not merge into one Abrahamic family, where we're called Ben or Bat Abraham. But everybody will share one inclusive blessing. That's as inclusive and non-discriminatory a promise as you'll find in the Hebrew Bible. We mess it up. We stand in the way of God's promise when we fight over either the promises or the prophecies. So that, for me, is a biblical foundation for sharing this space, sharing the Holy Land, sharing the world, and taking responsibility for its welfare and the welfare of its inhabitants, especially the coming generations. And I'll end with one other reference from Genesis, because we need to read our scriptures in ways that are other than self-referencing and self-preferencing. Our sages in our various traditions have tended to favor our own community as the chosen or blessed or favored community, the agents of God's redemption or salvation, and then the others are playing, you know, second fiddle in the orchestra, if they're in the orchestra at all. The conflict between Abraham's two wives, Sarah and Hagar, is often portrayed as some kind of existential dichotomy. Parentheses, I'm always amazed when I read Galatians 4, Paul turns it topsy-turvy. I'm not going to go into that now. I'll leave it for the New Testament exegetes. But Sarah and Hagar are even turned on their heads. But in the Genesis account, as we know, Sarah is the mother of Yitzhak, Isaac, and Hagar is the mother of Ishmael. Now, Ishmael represents a promise from God. Yishmael, God will hear this boy's prayers, and 12 princes will come from his loins. So that suggests a parallel trajectory to the 12 tribes of Yisrael, Jacob's new name after he struggles with this angel and walks away limping. So Yisrael, Yishmael seem to have parallel tracks of covenantal promise. In fact, Ishmael is circumcised together with Abraham in chapter 17. So he's part of that covenantal embrace from God. We Jews tend not to read it this way. We tend to see Hagar and Ishmael banished from the household in chapter 21. And the line and the story continue with Isaac. But it's not so one-dimensional. If you go back to chapter 16, when Hagar is fleeing from Sarah's jealousy and wrath, she ends up in this place in the desert, and God speaks to her. She is a prophet or prophetess. God speaks directly to her and tells her that she'll have this child named Ishmael, and everything will work out to her and his good. And her eyes are suddenly opened, and she sees a well, which may be parallel to Zamzam in the Islamic tradition of Hajar's source of water in the desert. And the Hajj pilgrimage, for those who know, have a lot to do with her search for water between Safa and Marwa outside Mecca. She opens her eyes, she sees this well, and she calls it Be'er Lachai Ro'i, the well of the living one who sees me. Very interesting designation. That's her term for this place. In chapter 24, 8 chapters later, Isaac is meditating in the field, walking out toward evening, and he's just returned from Be'er Lachai Ro'i, it says in the text. And the only reference was to Hagar and her well 8 chapters before. What was he doing while Eliezer is bringing Rebecca home back from the old country on the camel to be his wife? Interesting question. What was he doing there? That's 2 dots already around Be'er Lachai Ro'i. A few verses later, it says Abraham, still chapter 24, Abraham takes another wife, and her name is Keturah. Now, if you remember this little point at all, it probably didn't strike a resonant chord. Do you remember this at all? Abraham had another wife who bore more children. Her name is Keturah. In the Middle Ages, our greatest Bible commentator, Shlomo Bar Yitzhak, who's known as Rashi, says Keturah is actually Hagar's Egyptian identity. This is her true essence. Keturah is actually Hagar. But Hagar is related to Hager, which means the stranger or the alien. So in this Canaanite, in this Hebrew family in Hebron, El Khalil, she passes as the stranger from Egypt, but in separating, being separated from Sarah especially, but even from Abraham, she develops her true identity. And then Abraham remarries her, or they're already married, takes her back, according to this reading. The last dot is chapter 25, verse 9, where Abraham dies, and it says, Isaac and Ishmael, ooh, he suddenly reappears for one cameo appearance. The two sons bury Abraham together in the cave of Machpelah, which Abraham has bought from Ephron the Hittite in chapter 23, when Sarah dies. And then it says, Isaac went and dwelled at Be'er Lahairoi. There it is again. Third reference to the well of the living one who sees me. So the way I connect the dots, this is more inductive than didactic or explicit. But it's very clear to me in this reading that Isaac was doing some peacemaking within the family by visiting Hagar and Ishmael at Be'er Lahairoi. That's where they went when they were separated, because that's where Hagar had heard God's voice. And here was this sacred well in the desert, Zamzam or Be'er Lahairoi. That he had brought her and Abraham back together, but she is now independent keturah. And he's affected family reunification. So that when Abraham dies, it's a natural thing for Ishmael and Isaac to bury Abraham together. That's not a sudden development. And then, where would Isaac naturally live? His father and mother are both dead, but his half-brother, his childhood playmate, is still there. Does that make sense to you? I want to end with that question. Does that make sense? It makes sense to me, and it teaches us that already in the story about Jews and Arabs, our ancestors had already made peace around the grave of Abraham. Why are we still fighting over this territory, especially in Hebron, El Khalil, which has a lot of toxic energy between the 400 pseudo-messianic settlers and the 100,000 very faithful, fervently faithful Palestinian Muslims? Why are we doing this? Why can't we read our scriptures in that inclusive and even peace-oriented way? I'll leave it as a question, and let's try to answer it together. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ernesto, and I would welcome people to ask questions. I think we have about 20 minutes for questions and conversation. So, and as I said before, please come to the microphone for your question, and I'll let you field the question.
With pleasure. Now the fun part begins for me. Questions, comments, reactions. Please, you're invited to the microphone. And you can tell your name for the posterity through the podcast.
Peter Dula, I teach here in the Bible and Religion Department. Thank you for a very interesting lecture. I guess I sort of have two questions, or maybe one is a comment, one's a question, or one is an answer to your question. I mean, one possible way of approaching that question is to say that this is more of a political problem than a religious problem. So I guess maybe the way to phrase it as a question would be to ask you if you could historicize your portrayal of the conflict as religious as opposed to political. That is, I understand the kind of increasing fundamentalism in both Israel and Palestine in the last 20 years or so, but at least historically you have the founding of Israel as a secular state and Fatah as a secular institution. So kind of talk about that change. And then maybe the second question would be to ask you to go into some of the details of the peace process. So, I'm curious, what you called yourself a religious Zionist peace person, what that means for the West Bank, what it means for settlements, what it means for right of return, what it means for, I take it you're ruling out a one-state solution, but can you go into some of those details for us? Thanks.
Yeah, in just a few minutes. Well, Peter, I'm not sure you were setting up a distinction between the religious and political dimensions, and I'm trying to keep them together, so maybe we have different perspectives. I think our spiritualities are politically polluted by conflict, so we have to heal that, purge our spiritualities of this antagonism. And for better and for worse, our politics are spiritually / religiously colored, sometimes driven by theological, in some cases even theocratic, claims. So it's very, we can arbitrarily talk about this is religious and this is political, but in fact, in the monotheistic traditions, God didn't say, go to the desert and live sequestered in a monastery, but transform the society toward greater justice and peace. So this is all part of our spiritualities or our understandings of faithfulness. So I'm not sure. Now, what that means practically, what would the map of the Middle East, at least west, that corner to the eastern Mediterranean, look like? I think we need a confederation of three sovereign entities called Israel, Palestine, and Jordan, instead of Benelux. For Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg, we'd have Isfalur, Israel, Palestine, Urdun. And it could be that someday Jerusalem would be like the Brussels of Middle Eastern, economic and political community, perhaps. But in the meantime, these three communities, two of them have Palestinian majorities, Palestine, the West Bank, Jordan, East Jerusalem, and right now the Hashemite kingdom on the eastern side of the Jordan, and I don't know how that's going to evolve over time, whether the monarchy will prevail. But this Jewish majority state with 80% Jews, 20% Palestinians, called Medinat Yisrael, the State of Israel, would evolve once the war ends into a more pluralistic, democratic, non-discriminatory democracy with more equity among its citizens. Right now, the war mentality creates all kinds of rationales for inequalities, inequities. And Jerusalem should be the capital of two of the three states without a wall down the middle. So is that enough? The West Bank... minus a good number of the small settlements, about 25% or so of the Jews would move back into Israel the way the Gaza settlers moved back into Israel under Ariel Sharon. 75% of the Jews live on only 4 to 5% of the territory and by mutual consent could be annexed to Israel in exchange for exactly the same amount of territory given to Palestine by Israel next to Gaza and the southern part of the West Bank, south of Hebron, Al-Khalil. That land swap is already, I think, part of the Clinton parameters. That's, or certainly the Taba agreements that Yasser Abed Rabo and Yossi Beilin negotiated in the waning days of Ehud Barak's prime ministership. It's feasible. The question is the political will and courage to do it. Okay, yes.
Our press stresses the conflicts that are taking place and the pervasive conflict. Can you identify any conciliar moments that are of great meaning to you among the partisanship over Israel?
In history? Right. An inspirational moment in my life?
Contemporary, last, say, 10 years?
Oh, well, okay. I mentioned the last Israeli election just a couple of weeks ago. The rise of the centrist party is a heartening development because most of us feared it would go further right within Israel and we'd end up with a more hardline government under Netanyahu. Okay. Last 10 years, on the macro level, not too much. I was hopeful that when George Mitchell was appointed to be envoy to the region by Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, that he would do in Israel-Palestine what he had done in Northern Ireland. Basically, what he did, he wooed away the Sinn Féin pragmatists, Martin McGuinness and Gerry Adams, from the paramilitary terrorists of the IRA and other violent, hateful groups. So I was hoping that he would have a brief from the United States administration to actually talk with Hamas leaders, the way Jimmy Carter did in Damascus, that George Mitchell would do on a regular basis, and woo the pragmatists. Ismail Haniyeh, who runs Hamas, seems to me a pragmatist. It could be that Khaled Mashal even is a pragmatist, the fellow who's outside, who was in Damascus until recently, and with whom Jimmy Carter met. It remains to be seen, but if you don't test the waters, you never know the results, that he could engage them and see whether they might have first indirect and then direct negotiations together with Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, over the future of the land as a whole, to create two sovereign entities or even three sovereign entities. There may end up being two Palestinian states. And the Gaza may end up like Bangladesh, which was part of Pakistan at the beginning and then became Bangladesh. So it could be that Gaza and the West Bank will be a federated two-state Palestine. That's for the Palestinians to decide. The late Faisal al-Husseini, of blessed memory, with whom I talked in his office in Orient House in East Jerusalem, he wondered whether the Gazans and the West Bankers would ever actually coalesce into one political entity because their mentalities were so different. But it's not for me to tell them how they should govern themselves. As I said earlier, I have enough trouble with the Jews, getting them to accept one government when we have, I don't even know how many parties are now in the parliament, 8, 10? You know, we have a parliamentary system rather than a two-party system, and then we have to figure out how a coalition will govern the country. It seems that in Palestine there are only two factions, but even getting them together in some kind of reconciliation is extremely difficult. I'll tell you, looking back, it's more than 10 years, I think it was in 1977, a year before I arrived, the late Anwar al-Sadat, president of Egypt, arrived at Ben-Gurion Airport to make peace with Menachem Begin, and they shared a Nobel Peace Prize. If you'd asked Israelis on the street a week before, do you think there'd ever be peace with Egypt? They would have said, not in my lifetime. The way teenagers told me in Northern Ireland a while before the Good Friday Agreement, they didn't see any possibility of peace in Northern Ireland in their lifetime. So Israelis would have said, because I've been in Belfast twice, Israelis would have said, we'll never see that. A week later, Anwar al-Sadat, whose army had launched the Yom Kippur or the October War in 1973, which claimed the lives of 3,000 Israeli soldiers in the Sinai, he was welcomed as a hero on the way up the Judean hills from the coastal plain, from Ben-Gurion Airport to Jerusalem, where he addressed the Knesset. And Israeli school children were waving Egyptian flags as his motorcade went by. Amazing, truly amazing. A short time later, then President Yitzhak Navon was speaking his elegant literary Arabic to Cairenes on the streets of Cairo. That to me was a messianic moment. This is possible. It is possible. And I think it will happen. Will I live to see it? I don't know. Inshallah, God willing. But it's possible if we can get all of this, you know, toxicity out of the way. Yes. Finished. I'm done with that answer. Yes, who are you?
I'm Mansour from Iran. I'm doing my sabbatical here in CJP. Just, I've got a question. Have you ever thought about this conflict as a conflict over a land rather than being based on a faith? I mean, just the political leaders are playing with the faith as a tool to fight over the land.
Some politicians do that, very cynical and secular-minded politicians. But for religious people, not just those in religious parties, it's a fact, and we can judge whether this is a blessing or a curse. It's just part of reality that land, that God is the sovereign over time and space, history and geography, and the geographical parameters of our covenantal identities can't just be taken out of our hearts and souls. I know there are a lot of people who say, keep God and scriptures and religious arguments out of the diplomacy and we'll make peace more quickly. That may or may not be true, but I don't think that's possible. So my proposal is to bring more inclusively faithful religious individuals and groups, peace movements especially, into the diplomacy, people-to-people diplomacy, track two, growing into track one, so that we have a counter to the religious chauvinists with their militant, hostile agendas. Do you know, by the way, this internet campaign of Israel-loving Iran? All these Israelis reaching out to Iranians and Iranians reaching out in return to Israelis. Are you aware of this? One of the things that gives me some hope is Facebook and Twitter, neither which I use, but at least, you know, I can go online and see Israel, Red Heart, Iran, and then Israelis are sending this on the web all the time, and Iranians are writing back. So while the government administrations are sounding very belligerent, the people are saying, no, they don't speak for us. So that gives me hope. By the way, since we have some wonderful Shia sisters and brothers here, some of them Iranian, check out something I published online. If you were to Google Shiite Mahdism and Jewish Messianism, the ambivalent mingling of piety and politics, you'll have a scholarly but very practical reflection on how Shiites and Jews are like this spiritually, including our victim complexes, right? And our end of times apocalyptic scenarios, either of a Jewish Messiah or the hidden Imam coming back from Ghaiba and, you know, bringing equity and justice to the universe. All of this is largely to compensate for centuries of suffering. So we win. We've been losers, but God, you know, we're like the closers in the bullpen. We come back in the bottom of the ninth inning to win the game. God's game, of course, not our game. So Shiites and Jews actually are so similar if we could only get underneath the politics of what's happening at the top in Iran and Israel and see how the people might be spiritual brothers and sisters. Such strong affinities. So that's why I wrote that article. It was actually written originally as a course paper for my colleague and my downstairs neighbor, Dr. Mahmoud Ayoub. I took his course on Shiite Islam so I could understand what does it mean, 12ers and 7ers and all, because all the Muslims I met in Palestine were Sunnis. So it's only when I got to Hartford Seminary and now EMU that I can meet my Shia brothers and sisters. Alhamdulillah.
Hi.
Hi. Come on, come to the microphone.
Sure. I'm pretty loud, though.
But the podcast might not pick you up.
Hi. You have mentioned pathology and victim mentality. And as I have started to learn and understand more about trauma, and that traumatized people tend often to turn around to traumatize others, this really opened up for me a great deal of understanding, I think, about what's going on in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Can you speak to that more? And also, what is happening? What is being done to heal the deep, deep trauma of the Jews and the Palestinians as well?
Wow, great question. Thank you. What's your name?
Marilyn.
Marilyn. Not enough. And that's a very key therapeutic healing necessity. Yes, we have victim scripts, victim complexes, both Israeli Jews, including Israeli Jews, Palestinians, Shia Iranians, for them it's Yazid and the Sunnis, back to Karbala. We all have our chosen trauma, Miroslav Wolf says. So for us, it's 70 of the common era with the Romans. For Shias, it's Karbala and 680. Different for the Armenians, you know, the Armenian genocide. How to heal from these collective traumas is absolutely crucial. So the diplomats have to have training in trauma healing. What is being done? Well, part of the praxis at Open House, this peace laboratory, is based on what Dalia calls three A's. Acknowledgement, apology, amends. You have to acknowledge the harm done to the other side, even if it's one or two or 20 generations ago, in order to have an honest conversation about who's responsible for inflicting what in either direction, what harm, and the legacy of pain and grievance that persists. Some stated apology for the injustice. In case of Palestine, it's ongoing. Okay, Israeli policy still oppresses Palestinians, and that has to be acknowledged. And then practical rectification, tikkun, amends have to be put into practice. Not just lip service or symbolic gestures. In our case, creating an affirmative action Head Start nursery school for Arab toddlers in this house, which had been taken away from this Palestinian Muslim family, was an act of rectification to give Arab kids a solid foundation in their own culture, language, and identity before they went to school, before they went to kindergarten. So that's just one example. And I'm sure Mark Open will talk about others. In his book, Holy War, Holy Peace, he outlines some of the things that might be done. In the training course that we have had at Hartford Seminary, we devoted a whole evening to trauma healing. And this had nothing specifically to do with the Holy Land or the Middle East. But Jews, Christians, and Muslims have agendas of grievance toward one another over centuries. And unless we express them on the way to mutual appreciation, there will be this stumbling block. There is a great film that we used, and I don't know if it's been used at EMU. It's called The Apology, based in Australia. Do you know that? One where Prime Minister Kevin Rudd stated very graphically, explicitly, all of the crimes, the genocidal crimes that were committed by the white Europeans against the indigenous peoples of Australia. In New Zealand, the Maoris and the Europeans are a little bit ahead of the native, so-called Aboriginal Australians, but and the white European dominant group. The churches had played a major role in annual sorry days until it trickled up. And Prime Minister Rudd actually apologized on behalf of previous administrations and his own for all of the crimes committed against the indigenous Australians. And the tears come out of the screen at you and break your heart. And you can see the opening, the catharsis that this act brought about. So I am waiting for leaders, political and religious leaders in Israel, to state the truth about 1947-48, the expulsions of Palestinians, and ask for forgiveness. That would be a wonderful act of healing toward reconciliation. And we'll see what the reciprocal statements and gestures could be from Palestinian leaders, what they have done in their own self-interest, what they call resistance to what they think is Zionist aggression, ends up causing illegitimate harm to Israeli Jews and Arabs in their struggle for freedom and liberation and dignity. Yes, so is that a fair answer? You happy with that answer? But thank you for raising the question. It's an absolutely essential requirement for any political agreement, is getting to this emotional / spiritual healing. The best book of practical theology that I have ever read and that I use in my course every 2 years called Religion, Conflict, and Peacemaking is by my German Protestant theologian friend, Geico Müller-Fahrenholz, The Art of Forgiveness, Theological Reflections on Healing and Reconciliation. And he talks about how to really do this. I'll tell you one other short story. I have a friend, Yitzhak Mendelsohn, who is a psychologist in Jerusalem, who was a victim, truly a victim of politically inspired violence when Hamas gunmen shot up a street where he was sitting with his son and his stomach was shot open and his intestines were damaged until today. From his own experience as a psychologist who has been wounded, he is a wounded healer in Rwanda, and he goes to Rwanda again and again to deal with victims of the genocide there and help them heal. So this is called paying it forward internationally. Thank you, Marilyn. Yes, come. What's your name?
My name is John Asa Hertzler.
Hey, John.
I'm a Christian by religion, Mennonite by denomination. I'm not a scholar. I think my question goes back. Oh, let me say this, that a lot of what you've said and the stories you've told about Abraham, what we call Abraham, Sarah, and Isaac, and Ishmael, and Hagar, it's very touching. It's wonderful to hear that. The question before last that went to the land, I'm kind of hung up on the land. I wonder if the land is so deep in your being or psyche that it cannot be overcome, that it must be, the land must be shared. I know, I hear the word Holy Land, Holy Jerusalem. Muslims, I guess, maybe have Mecca, but I'm not sure just how important the real estate is there. Christians, I'm not sure whether there's the Vatican, but I've never heard it being the land being that holy. I'm just wondering how important is the land, is that a pediment to peace, and there's no getting away from that, or can there be more of a universalism, land not be so important? Thank you,
John. I appreciate your question. It could be that Christians like you can help people who are more attached to territory transcend their exclusive claims to it. However, to totally deterritorialize this particular conflict, I don't think is possible. By the way, ask Catholics if the Holy See is holy. Okay? The Catholics have a state. It used to be much bigger in Rome. Now it's, and they had papal states, and now it's just a little section of the Italian Republic's capital, but it's a holy see. For Armenians, the land of Armenia is holy. For Jews, the land of Israel is holy. For Muslims, there are certain haram holy sites, and it's not just the haram sharif. Al-Quds sharif is a holy domain. Jerusalem is a holy domain. So to ask people to give up this theological and spiritual self-understanding in their connection to God in spatial or territorial terms, I think John is asking too much. So the best is to neutralize the toxic potential of this kind of theology so it does not become what I call territoriolatry, which is a form of idolatry, of making the land into an end rather than a means of consecration, how to do that while listening to the spiritual self-identification of your fellow Abrahamic siblings, we have to do this together. That's all I can say. So when I see the Jewish quarter, the Armenian quarter, the universal Christian quarter, and the Muslim quarter in the old city of Jerusalem, I see some kind of map of pluralistic proximity within the Holy Mother City as a kind of model. Do you have anything I might drink?
But actually, I think we have to bring this to a close now.
Okay.
And thank you very much for what you brought. And we very much look forward to having you hear some more so we can hear much more from you and interact with you some more. One thing I forgot to mention in my introduction was that Yeheskel has recently been appointed to a newly endowed chair of Abrahamic Partnerships at Hartford Seminary, and which is quite an honor, and I had overlooked that, so I'm happy to say that now. I also want to introduce a special guest who arrived during this session, Dr. Hussein Ahmadi, who is the president of the Alavi Foundation, who is a real strong supporter of some of the work that Yeheskel has done at Hartford Seminary. He also has been supportive, or his foundation has been supportive of our center, and we're very pleased that he has came to hear this forum today. And finally, I wanted to take the liberty to mention that tonight at 7 o'clock is the class taught by Dr. Amir Akrami on issues in Islam, where he will be finishing up a section on Islamic theology and going into Islamic philosophy. And Yeheskel will be there also to chime in with some points on Jewish philosophy. So I think it's going to be an interesting interaction. And people would be, and I'm taking the liberty to say that people would be invited to come and listen to some of that, probably leaving many of the questions to the people who are registered for the class. So that would be at 7 o'clock in room 203, which is down the hall that way. And I want to thank you, Yeheskel, for your thoughtful input, everyone for being here, for the questions that were very stimulating, and wish you a good evening.
Can I make two more? I also want to thank you for coming and engaging these critical issues from your own perspectives. Two other things that are on the web, and I invite you to seek them out. One is a research report I was commissioned to do by the U.S. Institute of Peace, David Smock and his colleagues. It's called Healing the Holy Land, Interreligious Peace Building in Israel-Palestine. All you have to do is Google Healing the Holy Land, and you will find it. The other, I mentioned Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism. I didn't have the time to deepen this. I published an article, a reflection, in Studies in Christian-Jewish Relations, which is an online journal. It's called The Land of Israel in Jewish-Christian-Muslim Relations. And it takes a Kabbalistic typology of four worlds and four lenses or approaches to interpreting the Hebrew scriptures from the rabbinic tradition and uses these four approaches in sequence to look at how Israelis and Palestinians can heal their conflicted relationship. So this is applied mysticism, for what it's worth. The Land of Israel in Jewish-Christian-Muslim Relations. You can Google that and it'll come up. All right. Blessings to you all. Thank you.